We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you build or deepen your meditation practice and keep your brain healthy, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpis. Don't forget to check out the hundreds of free meditations on Meditation Studio app. You can find them at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Today's guest is Oren J. Sofer. Oren teaches mindfulness, meditation, and nonviolent communication in secular and Buddhist context. He holds a degree in comparative religions from Columbia University and is deeply engaged as a trainer in Marshall Rosenberg's work in nonviolent communication. His first book, Say What You Mean, offers valuable approaches to communicating with others, offering practical tools for having difficult conversations. His new book, Your Heart Was Made for This, combines his decades of training in nonviolent communication, Buddhism, and contemplative practice, and applies this to many of the pressing issues we face today, whether they be climate change, oppression, anxiety, burnout, and more. He offers us clarity and strength to meet life's immense challenges with courage and balance. His book offers ways for us to strengthen our hearts and nourish the qualities that can, in fact, transform the world. Now, here's Oren. Oren, it's really nice to have you on Untangle today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited for our conversation.
Yeah, and I want to talk about your new book, which is just being released. But I also want to start by hearing you share the background that has inspired you to the work that you do. And when I say the work that you do, you're a Buddhist, you're a mindfulness teacher. Your first book is called Say What You Mean. That's the work of nonviolent communication, but you combined it with mindfulness. What inspired you towards those practices?
It's always so interesting when we look back at our lives and try to trace the thread of where we've been and how we got to where we are. So there was a lot of upheaval in my family of origin growing up when one of my family members became mentally ill. And I think that set the stage for a lot of the very deep seeking that I did in my 20s and why this field of transformation and healing and really learning about what it is to be human has become the focus of my work. I wasn't able to deal with a lot of the feelings that came up as a child in relation to what felt really scary and overwhelming, not just to see this family member grow sick, but to see the effect it had on the whole family system and the pain and challenges that came up emotionally for all of us. And so I buried a lot of what was going on. I talk about this in my new book a lot more than in my first book, and really escaped into being busy. I was a straight A student at Columbia in New York City. I was a childhood actor. I was racing around the city, going to auditions, trying to avoid what I was feeling inside. And I didn't realize it until I was about 19. It had become such a strong habit that I had forgotten what I was even running from. And so when I first started to feel the ground shifting underneath me, these very, very deep feelings just starting to emerge the tiniest bit, I could sense how all-encompassing they were. And at the same time, I was taken by some of the academic study I was doing about Asian religions. The ideas really fascinated me and offered a perspective that was very consistent with intuitively how I viewed the world and understood my place, connection with nature. And so I ended up having the great privilege of being able to study abroad and go to India, to Bodh Gaya, the place where the Buddha was enlightened, and live in a Buddhist monastery and study Buddhism, both academically and practically, learning meditation from some really amazing Buddhist teachers. And it changed my life. It really turned things around in a profound way. And that started really the journey that I've been on for the last more than 25 years now. And so the nonviolent communication training came into my life about 5 or 6 years later, when I noticed that the qualities that I was cultivating in the formal meditation weren't translating into my relationships at work, into my relationships with my family. And that didn't sit well with me. It felt disconnecting and slightly disturbing to have such strong commitment inside to things like compassion, patience, empathy, listening, wisdom, clarity, patience, and to feel most of that evaporate very quickly when I would have an argument with somebody, or when one of my parents, your sibling, would say the smallest thing and just set me off, and all of the meditation practice would vanish. And then I would look back at the conversation an hour or two later and think to myself, oh my God, what did I do? How did that happen? So the nonviolent communication training provided a bridge. It provided a way to translate the values and the training of the meditation into my relationships and the rest of my life. So my first book, Say What You Mean, came out of that process, not just of learning nonviolent communication, but of integrating it into my life and making it my own. The second book, my most recent book, Your Heart Was Made for This, in some ways is a natural progression, because what I've learned from teaching communication now to many, many people and doing this work for a long time is two things. One, that in addition to having clear, powerful communication tools, we also need a whole host of transformative internal qualities to realize our values and our relationships and use the tools. It's very difficult to use the training that we have if we're not also at the same time cultivating patience, compassion, a commitment to integrity and non-harming, joy, gratitude. We need this very robust inner landscape of healthy resources to stay connected to our values and draw on the wisdom that we have in our life. The other thing I learned is that the communication training can be a vehicle for social change, in that it allows us to communicate, to collaborate, to build connections. But there's a whole bunch of other skills that we need to engage with the immense intersecting crises that we're facing. And so the most recent book is looking at, one, how do we build that inner resource kit to realize our values and our relationships? And then how does that translate into our lives as social beings and members of civil society?
Yeah, I love what you're saying. And one of the words that really stuck out for me that you just said was integration. Often we're really focused on our inner world and understanding our private selves. How do we really take this practice and all of these practices out into the world? And so you were saying when you get triggered, we need a host of tools and skillful means for handling how we get triggered. Just because we have a mindfulness practice and we meditate does not mean we are really good at handling our triggers or our reactivity to things. So thank you for that background, because it's really helpful, because I do think that your first book leads so elegantly into your second book. So I want to just lay a little bit of foundation for people who haven't read your first book. I wrote down the three main principles of nonviolent communication: lead with presence, come with curiosity and care, and focus on what matters. Can you talk for a few minutes about those principles and maybe offer a way for us to integrate them into our lives?
Yeah, and just to maybe clarify, so those principles are my own way of articulating the integration of mindfulness with nonviolent communication to provide a little bit of a roadmap for the training that we need to do. So the first principle, lead with presence, is an expression of the simple truth that if we want to understand anything, we have to be here first. Communication is about understanding one another and building enough connection to accomplish the task at hand, whether that is parenting a child or building a bridge and everything in between. So that depends on our capacity to be present, which, as we know, is becoming more and more difficult with the influence of technology, persuasive design, the attention economy. We are more and more fragmented and distracted. Mindfulness training is a wonderful tool, and there are many others, to develop more of our capacity to be present, not just in our lives, but specifically in our conversations with one another. So some of the tips that I give people for this that are the most immediately accessible are things like just pause for a moment before you speak, before you respond. Try to slow the pace of your speech down just a little bit so that you're more aware, more present. Feel your body. Notice your feet on the ground or your hands. These are simple, concrete tools to bring more presence and awareness into our conversations. And then there's a whole host of benefits that comes with that. Having more choice, having more agency, being less reactive, getting more information, having more stamina for when things get hard. So this is the first training guideline and tools and some benefits of it to lead with presence. This then gets us on the map. So now we're actually in the game because we're here. The second principle and training is about our intention. Where are we coming from? So much of our communication is not so much in the words, but in how we're coming across to one another. And many of the subtle signals we're sending, our facial expressions, our gesture, our tone of voice, and that is determined by a large degree by our intention. Intention is not the outcome we want, like my goal in this conversation is such and such. The way I define intention is it's the motivation behind our speech or our actions. It's where we're coming from inside, the heart quality or motivation behind what we're doing or saying. So one of the most powerful and transformative motivations or intentions in communication and relationships is simply the genuine intention to understand. And so the second training principle, to come from curiosity and care, is the invitation to cultivate our capacity to have an open mind, to check our assumptions, to really try to leave space for the other person's humanity and be curious. So much can shift just by coming from that place inside and having a genuine, sincere intention to understand, saying, let me see if I'm following. Can you explain more? I'd like to understand what's going on for you. So this is about an internal shift. And then it's also about how it shows up in the conversations. Things like checking that we've understood, asking open-ended questions, really listening when someone is talking rather than planning what we're going to say next or looking for ammunition for our argument, all of the things that we've been conditioned to do. So coming from curiosity and care starts to transform the relational atmosphere. It sets a different tone for the conversation. If you'll notice, the first two training guidelines, lead with presence, come from curiosity and care that form two-thirds of my model don't say anything about the words. And this is deliberate. It's because so much of our communication is nonverbal. You can say the exact same thing to two different people, to the same person on a different day, and it'll have a totally different effect, depending on the kind of day they're having and also where you're coming from and how you're saying it. So I really try to encourage people to remember that communication, skillful communication, is not in the words. It's not about what we say. It's about where we're coming from inside and the quality of connection and understanding that we're able to create with the other person. Now, I make this point so deliberately because in the third training of Focus on What Matters, we get into the nuts and bolts of how do you say that and wordsmithing and how do you make a request or an observation in a way that's going to lead to more understanding. The tendency of many of the people I work with, based on the conditioning of the predominant paradigm in the Western modern industrial world, is to try to get it right, is to try to control things, to have a model. And I want you to tell me what to say. What's the right way to say this? And what I've noticed is that if you're trying to say it the right way, you're probably going to create more confusion and disconnection than if you just spoke from your heart. One of the challenges of communication training is that we can get hung up on the form. We think there's a right way to say it, forgetting that I'm talking to another human being. Can I really relate to this person? So the third foundation is to focus on what matters. And this is pointing to many different things, but primarily it's focused on the key insight of nonviolent communication, which comes out of humanistic psychology, which is this principle that part of what makes us human is that we are motivated to meet underlying universal needs. These are core motivating factors for us as human beings that operate on a deeper level than the personal and culturally specific ideas we have about how to meet our needs. So these are things like safety, understanding, connection, belonging, having clean air and healthy drinking water, having access to healthcare and meaningful work, the things that all human beings want for themselves, their loved ones, their family, and their community. So to focus on what matters means that we train our attention to shift from our habitual way of interpreting one another through the lens of what's right and what's wrong and what should be and what shouldn't be to, can I connect with what really matters for this person? Even if I disagree with how they're going about it, can I see their humanity? So this is the training and attention, and this really opens the door to transformative relationships and experiences because it connects us to compassion, to our shared humanity.
As you're speaking, you're so skilled at articulate communication. And I know for myself and for others, often it's really difficult to understand our own feelings internally, to have that conversation with ourselves. How do I really feel? What are the words? How do I then communicate this to another person in a way that they will understand? And those steps from really being able to understand your own feelings and then being able to communicate them to someone else in a way that they will understand, because they may not have studied the things that you've studied. They may be coming from a completely different place. What is the how of this? How do we get this expertise? You've studied this for, you said 25 years, I think. What is our shortcut for becoming more able to?
Thanks, Patricia. There's a couple of things in your question that I want to highlight. One is the insight that you're sharing that communication is really at its core an interface of our inner worlds. It is this miraculous capacity that we have to take what's inside ourselves, externalize it, and then it becomes internalized to someone else. So your question of how do we understand and sort through and clarify what is actually happening inside so that we can make that bridge is, I think, really on point. I think the second piece about your question that has two parts for me that I want to highlight. What I'm hearing is, one, this deep valuing and longing for the practicality. How do we do this? How do we make it happen? And the other side, which is what I see so much in our world today, is tell me the shortcut.
Some of us may not have 25 years to learn this.
Exactly. Yeah. So I want to answer both sides of it. I want to answer the how, and I want to answer the time frame piece. Because what I've seen, not just in communication training, but in pretty much all dimensions of transformation, whether we are thinking about emotional, psychological, and spiritual healing internally, whether we are looking at the transformation and blossoming of an interpersonal relationship, whether that's a friendship, a life partner, or a professional collaboration, or whether we are looking at the evolution of society and social movements, is that these things take time. It is, by and large, the continual application of patient, steady effort, day by day, week by week, year by year, that leads to lasting transformation, rather than the momentary, intense catharsis that we might seek. And this is one of the core principles behind my newest book, Your Heart Was Made for This, which is that part of the incredible gift of being human is that in the time that we are granted, and none of us know how long that will be, we have this opportunity to realize our potential, to fulfill these amazing capacities in our heart for things as varied and miraculous as generosity, wonder, curiosity, determination and resolve, and patience. So to answer the question more specifically, I think the first thing to understand is that all of us have been communicating for most of our lives. We start speaking very young, and we internalize the habits, the assumptions, the worldview of those around us, our family, our religion, our culture, our society. So there's a lot of momentum behind our communication. Some of it's helpful, a lot of it is not helpful. So if we're wanting to transform that, the best way is to make one small change and stick with it. And the analogy that I use is, imagine a really massive ship at sea. It's got a lot of momentum. It's moving at a fast speed. You can't turn on a dime. And if you change the angle of the rudder 1 or 2 degrees, it seems like nothing is happening at first. But if you hold the angle over time, you will end up in a very, very different position. So how do we change our communication? How do we do this stuff? Look for what makes sense and connects for you in what we're sharing in this conversation, and then commit to it, integrate it. So if the thing that folks were listening, you heard something I said, maybe you took away like, oh, just pause, and that really connected for you, great. Just focus on that every day. Make it your intention. Practice it. Come back to it again and again and again until it becomes second nature. And then take on another training, take on another skill. This is how we make lasting transformation, one step at a time, integrating it.
This is how we learn anything new. It's practice, and it's one step at a time.
I just add to put a little bit more rails on my response to your question. There are a whole range of instructions and forms to clarify our inner life. And this is one of the incredible things we have received from the different lineages of spirituality and mysticism, as well as more modern techniques from therapy, psychology, communication training. So within nonviolent communication, I'll just pick up both pieces. So from the side of contemplation and spirituality, mindfulness, of course, provides an incredibly fruitful training for getting familiar with our inner life and starting to tease apart, what are our emotions? How do those differ from our thoughts? How do we experience that in our bodies? Are invaluable skills for us as human beings. Nonviolent communication adds a very important form for identifying what's happening inside. And the heart of that form that Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of nonviolent communication, offered is this training of recognizing our feelings or emotions and connecting them to deeper needs. This is the in and out breath of nonviolent communication. These two factors of how do I feel and why? What are the needs? How do you feel and why? What do you need? And the understanding here is that our emotions are information. They are a reflection and a function of deeper underlying core values. Because if we didn't care about something, we wouldn't have any feelings about it. It just wouldn't register. So if we have an emotion, most of the time it's because there's either some underlying core need that is being met and then we're feeling a pleasant emotion, or there's some underlying motivating factor, need, or value that is not being fulfilled or satisfied. And then there's an unpleasant emotion signaling that to us. So we can train ourselves to connect with and identify the feelings and needs in our own world and in the inner world of others. And this is really a powerful training once we start doing it that opens up into all kinds of clarity, agency, and compassion.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top-quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. I really liked your introduction. You said your heart was made for love, for connection, belonging, and meaningful relationship with other people, beings, and the earth. What brings us closer? What disconnects us? What are our biggest obstacles? Why is now more difficult than in previous generations? And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and maybe explain why it's more difficult now and what brings us closer and what disconnects us. And I love when you say your heart was made for love, because I think at the end of the day, it is all about that. Will you share what brings us closer, what disconnects us, and why it is more difficult today?
I can't know. I wasn't alive during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I wasn't alive during the Great Depression or World War I. I wasn't alive during the Black Plague or all of the things that the human species has lived through. And there is a philosopher who points out that every generation feels like their generation, the world is going to end and it's the worst that it's ever been. So there is something to be said for the perhaps relative nature of that perception. And yet, what I see and what I think many of us alive today see is that alongside the very real progress that we have made as a human species. We look at infant mortality, we look at access to basic sanitation and healthcare and clean water and food, basic safety, that we as a species have made tremendous strides from where we have come and where our ancestors have come from. And alongside that, there is not only tremendous income inequality and the ongoing violence of oppression and racism, sexism, all of the different forms of domination and control that infect our society. But the climate crisis is this existential threat for so much of life on the planet. And then the influence of technology and our devices and the way those are interfacing with our minds and affecting things like our capacity for empathy as we raise children, our ability to communicate and develop relationships, the overall mental health of the population, the sense of isolation or connectedness. I think that these challenges that we're facing today are unique in history in terms of, on the level of climate, the stakes, and on the level of technology, the profound pervasiveness in our day-to-day lives. So for these reasons and many others, the age of information, the access to news, it can seem like the challenge of recognizing, experiencing, and living from the innate goodness of our hearts is harder and harder. And I want to acknowledge that not everyone shares that belief or view that we are innately good. I think it's a tremendously important question because the way we structure our society is dependent in part on our view of human nature. Many of the institutions that we see today, the judicial institution, the criminal institution, even things like the way, at least in the United States, benefits and healthcare are structured or the lack thereof, all stem from a very particular worldview of human nature as inherently greedy and selfish. And what I see as a new parent is quite the opposite, that we come into this world so open and loving and joyful and curious. Just the other day, I was playing with my son on the couch. I gave him a little slice of apple, and he took such delight in sharing it with me. He's only 1 year old. He would take a little nibble and then he'd offer it to me and put it to my mouth for me to take a nibble. And then he'd nibble a little more and then he'd give it to me. Sharing and giving is in our DNA. It's so clear to me, seeing a new human come into this world, that what I have experienced and felt in my own meditation practice is not just true on the level of our emotions and our consciousness, but it's embedded in our biology. Went off on a tangent there. I can't even remember where we started.
I love hearing you just talk about your one-year-old son, because I could feel the delight in that moment. It matters. Those are the things that feed us, those moments. You also say in the book, even with the best intentions, the challenge of living in harmony with one another and the natural world is complex, which is what you were just talking about before you talked about your delicious son. And then you say, and still our actions matter individually and collectively. And I'll just say, I know a lot of people feel like their actions don't matter because things are so overwhelming. And then you ask the question, how do we meet our challenges and choose wisely? To truly meet something is to encounter it with awareness, enter into relationship with it, and respond appropriately. And that is a beautiful entryway into talking about how we can discover and cultivate the qualities that you're introducing in this book and how you have approached this in your own voice. So let's do that. I wonder if we can go through each one of the core qualities. I know I'm going to overwhelm you.
No, it's not going to overwhelm me. So just for the listeners here, the reason I'm laughing and Patricia laughing when she saw my face when she said that. So I just want to frame for people. So the book has 4 parts and 26 chapters, 26 qualities, which might sound like a random...
We're not going through all 26.
Oh, you meant the first core. You meant the first part.
I chose the ones I wanted you to talk about. And my intention is to have you talk for maybe 30 seconds about each. And if you go on longer, that's okay too. But to just give our listeners a flavor for these really important qualities that you are suggesting we practice in our lives. And regardless of how long it takes, that we take one step every day, that we choose what we want to focus on. And most importantly, that we have a choice. We have a choice. We can ignore all of these, which is our choice. or we can take the nuggets of what resonates with each one of us and integrate them into our own lives. So I thought getting a little taste of Oren.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I want to respond to some of the things you just said because it was so beautiful. And just elaborate a little on the underlying frame or ethos of the book. And then maybe we can explore some of the qualities. You're pointing to this capacity that we have that is really the foundation of the book to learn that what we know from modern neuroscience, which humans have known for millennia through contemplative practice, is that our hearts and minds, our consciousness is not fixed, that it is malleable, and that the things that we say and do every day, the situations we are in and the people we spend time with shape us. And that if we don't make an intentional effort to shape and train our hearts and minds in a particular way, well, guess what? The world around us is going to do it for us. And the world around us, how is that? What are the forces governing the world around us? A global capitalist economy that is built on chaos and limitless consumption and an extractive model. One of the analogies that I love for this, that I don't know if it made it into the book, is when we are born, we have the capacity to learn any of the hundreds of languages in the human species. Our brains, our neurology is primed to discern the whole range of sounds that form a language, as well as the patterning of grammar and any language. And so we all learn at least one language. Some of us are lucky and we might learn two or three when we grow up. So the analogy is that our heart and mind, and these are not separate in Asian philosophy. And so when I say your heart was made for this, I'm speaking not just about the emotional heart, but our whole inner consciousness, our inner life, our mind and our heart, similarly has the capacity to experience and express itself in all of these beautiful ways, all of the different qualities that I talk about in the book. Courage to equanimity, to devotion, to contentment and forgiveness. What a tragedy if we don't explore and develop this beautiful garden of qualities in the heart. And so the offer, the invitation, as you said, is to every day be practicing something, to be moving in that direction, to be sowing these beautiful seeds of transformation in our heart and through that in our world. So let's talk about some of them.
So I wrote down the first few qualities that you suggest are the core qualities, and this is in part one. You talked a little bit about attention. Do you want to say anything more about where we place our attention and how critical that is in our lives?
Attention is one of our most valuable resources. We live our life differently if we are conscious of how we use our attention. And as we know, there is a raging battle for our attention, because when you can capture and control someone's attention, there are two things that you can do. One, you can generate profit through advertising. And two, you can influence action. So we are in a battle for our attention. One of the tremendous benefits of meditation, the arts, contemplative practice, is that it allows us to reclaim our attention, which is a radical act in the modern age, and to actually strengthen the capacity to choose where we place our attention, rather than being pulled into our device or ruminating over things we can't control or that stupid thing we said or the relationship that we're worried about. We can use our attention to build inner strengths, so that when we're facing a challenge or difficulty in our life, instead of feeling helpless, we have more energy, more confidence, more clarity. And we can make choices about how we spend our time with placing our attention outwardly. What activities are we engaging with? What people are we spending time with? And recalling that there are countless ways to renew and enrich ourselves without reaching for a screen, spending time with friends, in nature, enjoying art, music, or poetry, exercising, dancing, learning about something, broadening our views. So individually, choosing where we place our attention, developing that capacity has a tremendous effect on our quality of life and how resourced we are. And then collectively, it has tremendous power, the power to tip the scales in the struggle for justice or to affect change by what we are choosing to do collectively.
It's so interesting to me because attention, it's just so big. And two of the recent interviews that we released, one was Mitra Manesh, who talks a lot about where we place our attention and how we make our choices, and Ellen Hendrickson, who focuses on social anxiety. And so much of her invitation was to look at where we place our attention and to be able to shift that. And so many of the interviews that we've done, there is this quality in many of them. It's so important. In a way, it's like what we always say in mindfulness, it's simple, but it's not easy. And so I think it makes so much sense. And it's not always easy.
It's not always easy. And that's why precisely what you just mentioned of the prevalence and the importance of attention is why it's the first chapter in the book. Because it's what allows us to start to steer and navigate. And what I talk about there is not just attention, but wise attention, which is starting to discern what is actually in my benefit. And to the simple part of what you're saying, we do this every day, and folks who are listening can try a short experiment. If you put your attention in your hands and just notice the sensations in your hands, and then put your attention in your feet and notice the sensations in your feet. And now come back to noticing the sound of my voice and listening to this interview, this conversation. You just moved your attention. You just consciously placed your attention in one place, then in a second place, then in a third place. We have this capacity and we can develop it. We can train ourselves. And that's the foundation for the whole book, is learning how to place our attention in different areas, because that's what allows us to cultivate these qualities and water these different potent seeds of transformation in our consciousness.
There's a whole body of work that is focused on chronic pain, and attention is such an interesting part of that. Will you talk about it for 1 second? Because I think it's so critical, and then we'll get back to the qualities.
Of course. I think that it's really essential because as human beings, we can't avoid pain. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the Buddhist principle that there is a difference between pain and suffering. And we all experience pain, not equally, definitely not equally, but what we do with our attention and in turn how we relate to that pain determines whether or not we will suffer and how much we will suffer. So when there is any kind of chronic pain, whether it is the pain of the body and chronic illness, whether it is the pain of emotions due to abuse or structural violence of poverty or racism, we need to learn how to use our attention wisely and nourish our spirits so that we have some relief. Otherwise, we become exhausted. So attention in relation to pain ties into things like being able to get enough rest, being able to nourish joy, being able to experience gratitude, which are some of the other qualities in the book. So we can choose to place our attention somewhere other than the pain, not out of an attempt to avoid, suppress, or destroy the pain, but out of a wise response to rebalance our inner life and cultivate some of the nourishment and the energy that we need to encounter and relate skillfully to the pain.
Thank you for going into that. The next quality is aspiration.
So I feel compelled for the listeners to just explain that I chose 26 qualities because my vision for this book is that folks will not sit down and read it in a week, but that they'll take a whole year. And so if you read one chapter every 2 weeks, that gives you a whole year, 52 weeks. And that's really the idea, is that it's a companion for our life, to take a concept or a chapter, to reflect on it, to work with it, to explore it, and really let it seep into our lives. So aspiration, this is the second chapter. Aspiration is our sense of what's possible in life. It's our North Star. One of the things I like to point out is that we all get trapped at some point in our lives by the stories we tell ourselves and the stories society tells us about what's possible, who we are, where we're going, I tell the story in the book, to go back to chronic pain, of suffering from Lyme disease and being at my father's house when he was in the hospital, also struggling with a life-threatening illness about 10 years before he actually passed. He recovered, and just feeling miserable. I was in pain, my head was foggy, and I was just sinking in a depression, feeling like sorry for myself. And then I remembered my training through meditation, that I was uncomfortable. The sensations in my body were unpleasant. But other than that, I was actually okay. I could think clearly, more or less. I had enough energy to take care of myself and even to take care of my father. And so I cultivated in that moment just the aspiration to take care of myself as best as I could. And I got up off the couch and I did some deep breathing and I did some Qigong, which is a gentle movement coordinated with breathing to bring energy into the body. And it shifted not the pain I was in, but the suffering, but how I was experiencing it. So aspiration is a sense of longing for something deeper, for something better, for something more fulfilling or just in our own lives, personally or collectively. And why it's so important is that if we don't have a sense of aspiration, we don't call forth the energy for change. And instead, we can end up at best just coasting and at worst sinking into depression and despair.
So is it connected with hope?
Hope is a tricky concept because it can mean different things. And I like to talk about practical hope or realistic hope, which is distinct from a certain fantasy, a certain ungrounded optimism. Well, everything's going to be okay. Let's just hope it gets better. I don't think that that is helpful or as helpful as practical hope, which is a synonym for aspiration. Ordinary hope places our sense of well-being on an imagined future beyond our control. And when that hoped-for outcome doesn't arrive, we are crushed. Whether it's healing from a diagnosis or getting the job or finding the soulmate, if we create that fantasy in our mind and say, I will be happier when, it's a very tenuous position because we're placing our sense of fulfillment on something that's outside of our influence. Practical hope and aspiration is based on the understanding that we live in a world of causality and that actions have effects. So what I do, what I say, and how I think today affects the future. It doesn't determine the future because, as you said earlier when we were talking about emotions, life is complex. There are way too many other factors influencing every moment for us to control the outcome, but we can influence it. What we say and do today has an effect on tomorrow. So aspiration and practical hope is the recognition that if I take steps in a certain direction, I'm more likely to end up where I'm wanting to go rather than just randomly where the world will take me. I want to say one more thing on this just to bring in the other dimension of the book, which is the connection between these qualities and the particular moment we're living in historically, and the need for really dramatic transformation on the collective level if there's going to be a habitable future for our children and grandchildren. And so we look at a quality like aspiration, and we see that on the collective level, it has the power to galvanize an entire population around a vision, to inspire people to give energy, time, resources to a vision of what's possible. And you just look at history and you see it over and over and over again. The Declaration of Independence is an articulation of a collective aspiration that this country is still struggling to live up to, that has sparked movements for democracy and sovereignty around the world. Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream speech, beautiful articulation of an aspiration collectively. And we see it in social movements again and again. So aspiration is not just something for our own personal lives. It is also something that we need as a society and as communities to navigate towards the world we want to build.
Which of the qualities that you have outlined in these 26 chapters do you feel will most powerfully lead us to a collective transformation?
Oh, it's a beautiful question, and I love that you're asking it. I'll answer it in two different ways. One, on the surface, I think that three of the qualities that are most important are the ones that are in the subtitle, and those are courage, integrity, and love. What we are experiencing collectively in our communities and to varying degrees in our personal lives in very intimate ways, whether it's economic pressure, environmental chaos, takes tremendous courage to be real about. And we can't change anything until we're real about it and face it head on. So I think for each of us to begin to understand that courage is not the absence of fear, it's the willingness to feel our fear and act in the face of fear. So to develop the courage to, in balanced ways, in manageable ways, turn towards the truth. This is one. Two, integrity. Integrity is about the tremendous sensitivity and beauty of our hearts. We feel it when another living being suffers if our hearts are attuned and open. And so much in our lives and in our world has, in many regards, forced us to shut down our hearts, to close our hearts in order to function, because there is so much overwhelming, there is so much pain. So developing the capacity to recognize and return to a sense of integrity. What do we actually care about? Who are we in the end? What do we value? That then gives us the inner strength to cultivate compassion, compassionate action, to respond. And then the last piece, love, which is so all-encompassing, because for me, love includes resolve and generosity and devotion and forgiveness. It's the broadest term for the innate goodness and power of the human heart, which for many of us, we've only scratched the surface of how it can really inform and uplift our lives. So to honor the power of love and to recognize it in our lives and to strengthen it as a force for energy, for healing, and for change. So this is one way I want to answer the question, is highlighting those three qualities that I chose for the subtitle, courage, integrity, and love. But the other way I want to answer it is more on the level of the different interaction of the qualities that is necessary. The reason the book is divided into four parts is that every part of the book takes us through a certain cycle, a certain pattern of development that is innate to the human psyche that the Buddha discovered and that is probably present in other traditions, although I haven't studied them carefully enough to map it. But it's a pattern of a wave of something, a foundation building and growing and then settling and integrating. So one part of it is beginning to recognize how we grow as human beings, that we need a foundation. We need to cultivate energy and strengthen that momentum. And then we need to integrate it. We need to live into it and allow it to settle into us in our life in a way that brings a certain kind of expansiveness and freedom and release. The other dynamic that is present throughout the book is a certain complementary quality. And we see this with things like qualities like energy and rest, or patience and resolve, or joy and compassion, or gratitude and generosity. We live in a world that has these complementary forces that work together. The sun rises and sets, our breath comes in and out, the seasons turn every year. And the same is true on the level of our consciousness and our spirit, is that we have to find a way to develop a certain rhythm and balance between these different movements of our heart, a movement outward to give, to serve, and a movement inward to renew and rest. a movement upwards of energy and resolve and devotion and giving, and a movement downwards of rest and ease and patience. So what are the qualities we need? On some level, for me, it's not so much about the specific quality as about beginning to understand these movements of energy through our life and learning how to participate with them in a way that nourishes us and places us in a position to participate in what's happening.
Thank you. I feel like your book could have been called Operating Instructions for Being a Human Being.
Oh, that's sweet. I like that. Thank you.
My last question for you is, what are three pieces of advice you would give your younger self, or perhaps you want to say your one-year-old son?
What I would share to my younger self or to my young son is, first, make time to take care of yourself. Second, notice the good in others. It's there if we look for it. And three, find ways to give and help.
That's perfect. Your son is very lucky.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom today. Really appreciate you being with us and so articulate about everything that's in the book and what you've learned in your life. So thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show and taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks for being with us today. You can pick up the book at all major booksellers and find out more about Oren at orinjsofer.com. Any comments or suggestions, please email us at untangle@choosemuse.com. We love hearing from you. And if you feel moved to write a review on Apple Podcasts, we'd love that too. We hope you have a great week, and we will see you next time.